In that sense, my work is indeed pointless. I mean, I'm a writer and social critic. I can't stop the plane from crashing. Nobody can. But I'm rather like the engineer who surveys the wreckage and locates the black box and takes it apart and writes up the report, the postmortem. And that, I believe, does have some small value, because finally we need to know why America failed. Thank you very much. There's a great myth in the United States of the self-made man or person. And this is always held up as, you know, if you're entrepreneurial enough, you can be like Bill Gates or whatever, or God forbid, Oprah Winfrey. And the thing is that by 1850, 4% of the New York population owned 50% of the wealth of that city. And so all the studies that have been made are that this lopsidedness of control has been a major feature, and that very, very few Americans escaped the social class into which they were born. So there's a mythology behind it. The question is, we tend to vilify the enemy, whoever that is. Is there something special about the U.S. that creates that pattern? And I would say yes, for the reasons that Marshall McLuhan said. Violence reflects a search for identity. We don't know who we are. We never did. And the notion that we were Republican or anti-monarchical, those ideals of the 18th century really blew away like dandelion spores by the time the War of Independence was over. You know, it's the United States has always been, I mean, this is the theme of why America failed. It has always been a hustling culture. And basically, if your goal in life is more, then you have no goal. Because once you have more, then there's always more. You know, it never ends. So who are we and what are we doing? And once you have that kind of emptiness at the center, you're going to be quite violent. And de Tocqueville talked about this in Democracy in America. He said, Americans are really strange. They live in a perpetual state of self-adoration. They're always saying how fabulous they are. And he said, if you challenge that, they get very fierce very quickly. This is 1831. Not too bad, not too shabby an assessment. The question was, I must have some observations about how we're going to get out of this mess. And my answer was, you leave the mess. That's what I did. I would encourage everybody to do that. I get letters on my blog regularly, especially from young people, what should I do? And I say, what do you think is waiting for you 30 or 40 years down the line when there's no Social Security, no Medicare, no social safety net whatsoever, and we are making yet another war on some forcocked country on the other side of the planet and spending trillions of dollars to do that, whoever they are, and if we run out of countries, we're going to invade Antarctica and clean up those communistic penguins that are creating problems. There's no end to this. We don't know how to do anything else. And the chance that we have, quite honestly, of turning this around are roughly the chances that we have or would have of turning around an aircraft carrier in a bathtub. So quite frankly, not only is there no way out, but I would recommend you get out. Things will only get worse in the United States, and frankly, they could get very ugly. They could get quite nasty. There are already signs of that. This cruelty that I talked about is quite endemic. And I think that it's not that unusual to think that maybe 10, 15 years from now, a book like this couldn't be sold, couldn't be published. You know, I did submit it to 13, my agent submitted it to 13 publishers, 12 turned it down. Three of those said, this is too hot for us to handle. They were honest. The rest came up with answers that I had to decode, you know, because they do a little song and dance, you know. But it was either it was too hot to handle, or it was, we can't make enough money on this. It's not commercially viable. It was interesting because a number of these that turned it down used adjectives to describe the book like groundbreaking, wonderful was what one publisher said. We're going to pass on it. So you mean if it was less wonderful, then you'd publish it? You know, I should have made it less wonderful. The Occupy Wall Street movement is an interesting thing to consider. But the general tendency in the United States as far as revolution goes is that it would occur from the right, not from the left. And I don't think that's too far-fetched and makes me edgy, you know, I have to say. But, you know, I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, you know. I'm just the question is, not everybody can leave the United States. What if you do if you're trapped here? What if you do if you can't get out? I did answer that in the first book in the series, Twilight of American Culture. Yeah, right. Basically, look, there are three possibilities. One is that that you could change the country, turn it totally upside down. That's not a possibility. The second is that you leave. Okay. The third is, if you can't, you have to do a kind of inner emigration. And that's what the monastic option was about. In other words, you have to find on a local basis, which I never was able to do. You have to find on a local basis communities, groups, grassroots organizations, study groups, whatever it is, that enable you to work toward the preservation of what's good in the culture, and then you take your chances in terms of what's going to happen. I have to say that I didn't have, personally, the resources. I mean, I primarily left the country because I had no one to talk to, quite literally, and it was getting pretty lonely. But it was also the case that while I was living in Washington, D.C. for 8 years, and my goal was to be, you know, like the proverbial lotus in the cesspool. By the end of those 8 years, I just became a dirty lotus. You know, I mean, it didn't work, you know. I was shabby lotus, you know. And so what was left for me, really? So, but, I mean, it's obviously an important question, but that's what I would recommend, fully undertaking the monastic option. You can live in a certain way. You can try to influence the people around you. You can organize in a local sense. What else do you have? But on a local level, there are some possibilities. I never found it myself, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I mean, I mentioned earlier, I said that I was here from the aegis of the largesse of the Parent Coaching Institute in Bellevue that paid my airfare. They are like that. That's a group of about 50 or 75 people that are really like-minded folks and have come together to try to, their goal is to teach parents how to protect their kids from American culture. You know, screens, cell phones, iPods, violence, television. How do you protect your kids from all that garbage? And they do the best they can. And my hat's off to them. Yeah. Yes? Given the fact that the world is economically integrated and globalized and so on and so forth, is there really anywhere to hide? Okay, is there anywhere else you could go? The answer is yes and no. For example, why did I pick Mexico? I picked Mexico because it still has elements of traditional culture in it. And although the country is highly Americanized, I taught at a university in Mexico City for a year and a half, and those kids just wanted to be part of the economic elite. That was their goal, and America was their model, you know. That is present all over Mexico, and yet at the same time, it remains this ancient culture that was invaded by Cortes in the 16th century and still retains elements of traditional culture. You will find pockets of that everywhere in the world. And, you know, it's up to you whether you can immigrate, want to immigrate, and so on and so forth. But I couldn't see myself, for example, moving to Scandinavia where everybody is running around with Nokia next to their ear. I mean, that's not my idea of a society I want to live in. I wanted to live in a society where people are relaxed, like the American South. It's slowed down. It's a mañana culture. And I have to say that the result of that, for me, was I've been there 5 years. Within a four-year period, I wrote 4 books, one of which is a novel and the other a volume of poetry. It does very good things for your soul to slow down. I highly recommend it. And so my life changed dramatically as a result of leaving. And when people, Americans, say to me, do you regret, do you have any regrets about your move to Mexico? I say, yes, that I didn't do it 20 years ago. That's my regret. Could have saved myself a lot of grief. And you will find those types of pockets everywhere, even though the dominant culture is this kind of what I call affluent depravity. I mean, a culture, a consumer corporate culture that seeps into everything, including our romantic relationships, you know, everything, you know. So on one level, yes, it's really hard to escape it. On the other hand, you can do it to some extent. You can't do it completely, but you can do it. The question was, well, what about our conquering Hitler and the opposition to World War II and that we triumphed and that was important? All that's true, but the problem is that was an unusual war, and what the right wing in the United States has convinced the rest of the country is that every war we get into is like that. So Ho Chi Minh was Hitler, and Saddam Hussein was Hitler. They're all Hitler, and that becomes the model of war, when in fact there was only one Hitler and one war like that. That's why I said, in the case of our opposition to Germany, that's the one case that I think we were justified, you know, that it really was the darkest of evil and that we had to defeat it, and I doubt I'd be here without that, you know. So that's fine. That's great. The only trouble is that it is not representative of the wars we have fought since 1945, even though every time Chamberlain, appeasement, Hitler are trotted out as reasons for us to go and kick the crap out of whatever, you know, Grenada or something. Whatever it is we're going to do, it's Hitler redux, and we're going to repeat the same story.
I see these two countries, China and America, saying, okay, we have to be more competitive. Look at China.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese say, well, we have to catch up with America. Together, these two countries will maintain the world order of techno material or something like that. Our planet's resources will be continued and exploited in the same model, which is not a antagonistic model.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Soviet Union. What do you think about this model?
Well, I know that China is buying our debt. And without that, the American economic system would have crashed even worse than it did in 2008. I also would say that eventually they're going to get tired of doing that. Since Deng Xiaoping, I always regarded China as basically the United States in Mandarin. You know, it's not quite the same because it's an authoritarian capitalism. It's a very much a state kind of capitalism. It's a little different. But certainly the things that are characteristic of the United States, like 1% of the population owning 47% of the wealth and stuff like that, all that is characteristic of China now. You know, that social inequality is definitely there. But the question was the issue of American exceptionalism and its relationship to the religiosity of the United States. I have to tell you that secular people believe American exceptionalism as well. I have a friend who's dean of a major medical school in the United States, and in Dark Ages America, I have a discussion of a book by Joyce Appleby, who's used to teach at Harvard. What is it called? Capitalism and a New Social Order. That's the name of her book. And she talks about in the 1790s that the definition of virtue significantly shifted in the United States from contributing to the community toward making it for yourself in an opportunistic environment. It actually antedated the 1790s by 100 years, but linguistically that happened with the definition of virtue. She's right about that. And he was very taken by this. And being a dean, you know, he's a lot of, you know, cocktail parties and meetings and functions and all that that has to survive and go to. And he would raise the topic with faculty members. I just read this book. What do you think? Within 30 seconds, their eyes glazed over and they changed the subject. This is among the most intelligent people in the United States we're talking about. It's not about, and they're not religious. These are secular. Americans simply can't tolerate this ontologically in their guts. They can't tolerate this kind of awareness of what America is. The religion of America is in fact America. It's not Protestantism or anything else. And as early as 1955, in a very famous book, Will Herberg pegged this. It was called Protestant Catholic Jew, in which he said, yeah, you have Protestant Catholics and Jews in the United States, but everybody's worshiping the United States. That's the civil religion. And so when you raise this at cocktail parties or whatever, the reason their eyes glaze over is as though you were saying to an alcoholic, why don't you put down that glass of scotch? Ain't gonna happen. Thank you very much.
Now, it seems to me that money could also be seen as the religion of America. Those activities which bring the individual a net income are understood to be good activities, virtuous, if you like, and the sinful, wrong activities are those which are instantly punished by a net outflow of money. I would explain a lot of the problems that Berman highlights with respect to money and its use to destroy local, traditional, alternative value systems and replace them with a single, top-down, hierarchical system. For more on the effects of money, we'll read from David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Chapter 4. Cruelty and Redemption. It begins with a quote from the Book of Amos. We will buy the poor for silver, the needy for a pair of sandals. The reader may have noticed that there's an unresolved debate between those who see money as a commodity and those who see it as an IOU. Which one is it? By now, the answer should be obvious. It's both. Keith Hart, probably the best-known current anthropological authority on the subject, pointed this out many years ago. There are, he famously observed, two sides to any coin. Quote, look at a coin from your pocket. On one side is heads, the symbol of the political authority which minted the coin. On the other side is tails, the precise specification of the amount the coin is worth as payment in exchange. One side reminds us that states underwrite currencies, and that the money is originally a relation between persons in society, a token perhaps. The other reveals the coin as a thing capable of entering into definite relations with other things. Unquote. Clearly, money was not invented to overcome the inconveniences of barter between neighbours, since neighbours would have no reason to engage in barter in the first place. Still, a system of pure credit money would have serious inconveniences as well. Credit money is based on trust, and in competitive markets, trust itself becomes a scarce commodity. This is particularly true of dealings between strangers. Within the Roman Empire, a silver coin stamped with the image of Tiberius might have circulated at a value considerably higher than the value of the silver it contained. Ancient coins invariably circulated at a value higher than their metal content. This was largely because Tiberius's government was willing to accept them at face value. However, the Persian government certainly wasn't, and the Mauryan and Chinese governments certainly weren't. Very large numbers of Roman gold and silver coins did end up in India and even China. This is presumably the main reason that they were made of gold and silver to begin with. What's true for a vast empire like Rome or China is obviously all the more true for a Sumerian or Greek city-state, let alone anyone operating within a kind of broken checkerboard of kingdom towns and tiny principalities that prevailed in most of medieval Europe or India. As I've pointed out, often what was inside and what was outside were not especially clear. Within a community, a town, a city, a guild, or religious society, pretty much anything could function as money, provided that everyone knew someone was willing to accept it to cancel out a debt. To offer one particularly striking example, in certain cities in 19th century Siam, small change consisted entirely of porcelain Chinese gaming counters, basically the equivalent of poker chips, issued by local casinos. If one of these casinos went out of business or lost its license, its owners would have to send a crier through the streets, banging a gong and announcing that anyone holding such chits had 3 days to redeem them. For major transactions, of course, currency that was also acceptable outside the community, usually silver or gold again, was ordinarily employed. In a similar way, English shops, for many centuries, would issue their own wood or lead or leather token money. The practice was often technically illegal, but it continued until relatively recent times. Here is an example from the 17th century by a certain Henry who had a store at Stony Stratford, Buckinghamshire. And there's an image of Henry Honour, 1664, halfpenny in Stony Stratford. This is clearly a case of the same principle. Henry would provide small change in the form of IOUs redeemable at his own store. As such, they might circulate broadly, at least among anyone who did regular business at that shop, but they were most unlikely to travel very far from Stony Stratford. Most tokens, in fact, never circulated more than a few blocks in any direction. For larger transaction, everyone, including Henry, expected money in a form that would be acceptable anywhere, including in Italy or France. Throughout most of history, even where we do find elaborate markets, we also find a complex jumble of different sorts of currency. Some of these may have originally emerged from barter between foreigners. The cocoa money of Mesoamerica or salt money of Ethiopia are frequently cited examples. Others arose from credit systems or from arguments over what sort of goods should be acceptable to pay taxes or other debts. Such questions were often matters of endless contestation. One could often learn a lot about the balance of political forces in a given time and place by what sort of things were acceptable as currency. For instance, in much the same way that colonial Virginia planters managed to pass a law obliging shopkeepers to accept their tobacco as currency, medieval Pomeranian peasants appear to have at certain points convinced their rulers to make taxes, fees, and customs duties, which were registered in Roman currency, actually payable in wine, cheese, peppers, chicken, eggs, and even herring, much to the annoyance of travelling merchants, who therefore had to either carry such things around in order to pay the tolls, or buy them locally at prices that would have been more advantageous to their suppliers for that very reason. This was in an area with a free peasantry rather than serfs. They were in a relatively strong political position. In other times and places, the interests of lords and merchants prevailed instead. Thus, money is almost always something hovering between a commodity and a debt token. This is probably why coins, pieces of silver or gold, that are already valuable commodities in themselves, but that being stamped with an emblem of a local political authority, become even more valuable, still sit in our heads as the quintessential form of money. They most perfectly straddle the divide that defines what money is in the first place. What's more, the relation between the two was a matter of constant political contestation. In other words, the battle between state and market, between governments and merchants, is not inherent to the human condition. Our two origin stories, the myth of barter and the myth of primordial debt, may appear to be about as far apart as they could be, but, in their own way, they are also two sides of the same coin. One assumes the other. It's only once we can imagine life as a series of commercial transactions that we're capable of seeing our relation to the universe in terms of debt. To illustrate, let me call a perhaps surprising witness, Friedrich Nietzsche, a man able to see with uncommon clarity what happens when you try to imagine the world in commercial terms. Nietzsche's On the Genealogy of Morals appeared in 1887. In it, he begins with an argument that might as well have been taken directly from Adam Smith. But he takes it a step further than Smith ever dared to, insisting that not just barter, but buying and selling itself, precede any other form of human relationship. The feeling of personal obligation, he observes, quote, has its origin in the oldest and most primitive personal relationship there is, in the relationship between seller and buyer, creditor and debtor. Here, for the first time, one person moved up against another person. Here, an individual measured himself against another individual. We have found no civilization still at such a low level that something of this relationship is not already perceptible. To set prices, to measure values, to think up equivalences, to exchange things, that preoccupied man's very first thinking to such a degree that, in a certain sense, it's what thinking itself is. Here, the oldest form of astuteness was bred. Here, too, we can assume are the first beginnings of man's pride, his feeling of preeminence in relation to other animals. Perhaps our word man, manas, continues to express directly something of this feeling of the self. The human being describes himself as a being which assesses values, which values and measures, as the inherently calculating animal. Selling and buying, together with their psychological attributes, are even older than the beginnings of any form of social organizations and groupings. Out of the most rudimentary form of personal legal rights, the budding feeling of exchange
contract, guilt, law, duty, and compensation was instead first transferred to the crudest and earliest social structures in their relationships with similar social structures, along with the habit of comparing power with power, of measuring, of calculating. Unquote. As Smith, too, we will remember, saw the origins of language, and hence of human thought, as lying in our propensity to exchange one thing for another, in which he also saw the origins of the market. The urge to trade, to compare values, is the very thing that makes us intelligent beings, and different from other animals. Society comes later, which means our ideas about responsibilities to other people first take shape in strictly commercial terms. Unlike Smith, however, it never occurred to Nietzsche that you could have a world where all such transactions immediately cancel out. Any system of commercial accounting, he assumed, will produce creditors and debtors. In fact, he believed that it was from this very fact that human morality emerged. Note, he says, how the German word Schuld means both debt and guilt. At first, to be in debt was simply to be guilty, and creditors delighted in punishing debtors unable to repay their loans by inflicting, quote, all sorts of humiliation and torture on the body of the debtor, for instance, cutting as much flesh off as seemed appropriate for the debt, unquote. In fact, Nietzsche went so far as to insist that those original barbarian law codes that tabulated so much for a ruined eye, so much for a severed finger, were not originally meant to fix rates of monetary compensation for the loss of eyes and fingers, but to establish how much of the debtor's body creditors were allowed to take. Needless to say, he doesn't provide a scintilla of evidence for this, but none exists. But to ask for evidence would be to miss the point. We're dealing here not with a real historical argument, but with a purely imaginative exercise. When humans did begin to form communities, Nietzsche continues, they necessarily began to imagine their relationship to the community in these terms. The tribe provides them with peace and security. They are therefore in its debt. Obeying its laws is a way of paying it back, paying your debt to society again. But this debt, he says, is also paid, here too, in sacrifice. Quote, within the original tribal cooperatives, we are talking about primeval times, the living generation always acknowledged a legal obligation to the previous generations, and especially to the earliest one which had founded the tribe. Here, the reigning conviction is that the tribe only exists at all only because of the sacrifices and achievements of its ancestors, and that people have to pay them back with sacrifices and achievements. In this, people recognize a debt which keeps steadily growing, because these ancestors, in their continuing existence as powerful spirits, do not stop giving the tribe new advantages and lending them their power. Do they do this for free? But there is no for free for those raw and spiritually destitute ages. What can people give back to them? Sacrifices, at first as nourishment, understood very crudely, festivals, chapels, signs of honour, above all, obedience, for all customs, as work of one's ancestors, are also their statutes and commands. Do people ever give them enough? This suspicion remains and grows. Unquote. In other words, for Nietzsche, starting from Adam Smith's assumptions about human nature means we must necessarily end up with something very much along the lines of primordial debt theory. On the one hand, it's because of our feeling of debt to the ancestors that we obey the ancestral laws. This is why we feel that the community has the right to react like an angry creditor, and punish us for our transgressions if we break them. In the larger sense, we develop a creeping feeling that we could never really pay back the ancestors, that no sacrifice, not even the sacrifice of our firstborn, will ever truly redeem us. We're terrified of the ancestors, and the stronger and more powerful a community becomes, the more powerful they seem to be, until finally, quote, the ancestor is necessarily transfigured into a god, unquote. As communities grow into kingdoms and kingdoms into universal empires, the gods themselves come to seem more universal. They take on grander, more cosmic pretensions, ruling the heavens, casting thunderbolts, culminating in the Christian god, who, as the maximal deity, necessarily, quote, brought about the maximum feeling of indebtedness on earth, unquote. Even our ancestor Adam is no longer figured as a creditor, but as a transgressor, and therefore a debtor, who passes on to us his burden of original sin. Quote, finally, with the impossibility of discharging the debt, people also come up with the notion that it is impossible to remove the penance. The idea that it cannot be paid off, eternal punishment, until all of a sudden we confront the paradoxical and horrifying expedient with which a martyred humanity found temporary relief. That stroke of genius of Christianity, God sacrificing himself for the guilt of human beings, God paying himself back with himself, God as the only one who can redeem man from what, for human beings, has become impossible to redeem, the creditor sacrificing himself for the debtor, out of love. Can people believe that? Out of love for his debtor. Unquote. It all makes perfect sense if you start from Nietzsche's initial premise. The problem is that the premise is insane. There is also every reason to believe that Nietzsche knew that the premise was insane. In fact, that this was the entire point. What Nietzsche is doing here is starting out from the standard common-sense assumptions about the nature of human beings, prevalent in his day, and to a large extent still prevalent, that we are rational, calculating machines, that commercial self-interest comes before society, that society itself is just a way of putting a kind of temporary lid on the resulting conflict. That is, he is starting out from ordinary bourgeois assumptions and driving them to a place where they can only shock a bourgeois audience. It's a worthy game, and no one has ever played it better, but it's a game played entirely within the boundaries of bourgeois thought. It has nothing to say to anything that lies beyond that. The best response to anyone who wants to take seriously Nietzsche's fantasies about savage hunters chopping pieces off each other's bodies for failure to remit are the words of an actual hunter-gatherer, an Inuit from Greenland, made famous in the Danish writer Peder Frøyen's Book of the Eskimo. Frøyen tells us how one day, after coming up hungry from an unsuccessful walrus hunting expedition, he found one of the successful hunters dropping off several hundred pounds of meat. He thanked him profusely. The man objected indignantly. "Up in our country we are human," said the hunter. "And since we are human, we help each other. We don't like to hear anybody say thanks for that. What I get today, you may get tomorrow. Up here we say that by gifts one makes slaves, and by whips one makes dogs." The last line is something of an anthropological classic, and similar statements about the refusal to calculate credits and debts can be found through the anthropological literature on egalitarian hunting societies. Rather than seeing himself as human because he could make economic calculations, the hunter insisted that being truly human meant refusing to make such calculations. Refusing to measure or remember who had given what to whom, for the precise reason that doing so would inevitably create a world where we begin comparing power with power, measuring, calculating, and reducing each other to slaves, or dogs, through debt. It's not that he,
like untold millions of similar egalitarian spirits throughout history, was unaware that humans have a propensity to calculate. If he wasn't aware of it, he couldn't have said what he did. Of course we have a propensity to calculate. We have all sorts of propensities. In any real-life situation, we have propensities that drive us in several different contradictory directions simultaneously. No one is more real than any other. The real question is, which we take as the foundation of our humanity, and therefore make the basis of our civilization. If Nietzsche's analysis of debt is helpful to us, then, it is because it reveals that when we start from the assumption that human thought is essentially a matter of commercial calculation, that buying and selling are the basis of human society, then yes, once we begin to think about our relationship with the cosmos, we will necessarily conceive of it in terms of debt. I do think Nietzsche helps us in another way as well, to understand the concept of redemption. Nietzsche's account of primeval times might be absurd, but his description of Christianity, of how a sense of debt is transformed into an abiding sense of guilt, and guilt to self-loathing, and self-loathing to self-torture, all of this does ring very true. Why, for instance, do we refer to Christ as the Redeemer? The primary meaning of redemption is to buy something back, or to recover something that had been given up in security for a loan, to acquire something by paying off a debt. It is rather striking to think that the very core of the Christian message, salvation itself, the sacrifice of God's own Son to rescue humanity from eternal damnation, should be framed in the language of a financial transaction. Nietzsche might have been starting from the same assumptions as Adam Smith, but clearly the early Christians weren't. The roots of this thinking lie deeper than Smith's with his nation of shopkeepers. The authors of the Brahmanas were not alone in borrowing the language of the marketplace as a way of thinking about the human condition. Indeed, to one degree or another, all the major world religions do this. The reason is that all of them, from Zoroastrianism to Islam, arose amidst intense arguments about the role of money and the market in human life, and particularly about what these institutions meant for fundamental questions of what human beings owed to one another. The question of debt and arguments about debt ran through every aspect of the political life of the time. These arguments were set amidst revolts, petitions, reformist movements. Some such movements gained allies in the temples and palaces. Others were brutally suppressed. Most of the terms, slogans, and specific issues being debated, though, have been lost to history. We just don't know what a political debate in a Syrian tavern in 750 BC was likely to be about. As a result, we've spent thousands of years contemplating sacred texts full of political allusions that would have been instantly recognizable to any reader at the time when they were written, but whose meaning now we can only guess at. One of the unusual things about the Bible is that it preserves some bits of this larger context. To return to the notion of redemption, the Hebrew words pada and gol, both translated as redemption, could be used for buying back anything one had sold to someone else, particularly the recovery of ancestral land, or to recovering some object held by creditors in way of a pledge. The example foremost in the minds of prophets and theologians seems to have been the last, the redemption of pledges, and especially of family members held as debt pawns. It would seem that the economy of the Hebrew kingdoms, by the time of the prophets, was already beginning to develop in the same kind of debt crisis that had long been common in Mesopotamia. Essentially, in years of bad harvests, the poor became indebted to rich neighbors or to wealthy moneylenders in the towns. They would begin to lose title to their fields and become tenants on what had been their own land. Their sons and daughters would be removed to serve as servants in the creditors' households, or even sold abroad as slaves. The earlier prophets contain allusions to such crises, but the book of Nehemiah, written in Persian times, is the most explicit. Quote, "Some also were there that said, We have mortgaged our lands, vineyards and houses,
that we might buy corn, because of the dearth. There were also those that said, We have borrowed money for the king's tribute, and that upon our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children, and lo, we bring into bondage our sons and daughters to be servants. Some of our sons and daughters are brought under bondage already, neither is it in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. And I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Then I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers, and said to them, Ye exact usury, every one of his brother. And I set a great assembly against them. Unquote. Nehemiah was a Jew, born in Babylon, a former cupbearer to the Persian emperor. In 444 BC, he managed to talk the great king into appointing him governor of his native Judea. He also received permission to rebuild the Temple of Jerusalem that had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar more than 2 centuries earlier. In the course of rebuilding, sacred texts were recovered and restored. In a sense, this was the moment of the creation of what we now consider Judaism. The problem was that Nehemiah quickly found himself confronted with a social crisis. All around him, impoverished peasants were unable to pay their taxes. Creditors were carrying off the children of the poor. His first response was to issue a classic Babylonian-style clean slate edict. Having himself been born in Babylon, he was clearly familiar with the general principle. All non-commercial debts were to be forgiven. Maximum interest rates were set. At the same time, though, Nehemiah managed to locate, revise, and reissue much older Jewish laws, now preserved in Exodus, Deuteronomy, and Leviticus, which in certain ways went even further by institutionalizing the principle. The most famous of these is the Law of the Jubilee, a law that stipulated that all debts would automatically be cancelled in the Sabbath year, that is, after 7 years had passed, and that all who languished in bondage owing to such debts would be released. Freedom, in the Bible, as in Mesopotamia, came to refer, above all, to release from the effects of debt. Over time, the history of the Jewish people itself came to be interpreted in this light. The liberation from bondage in Egypt was God's first paradigmatic act of redemption. The historical tribulations of the Jews, defeat, conquest, exile, were seen as misfortunes that would eventually lead to a final redemption with the coming of the Messiah. Though this could only be accomplished, prophets such as Jeremiah warned them after the Jewish people truly repented of their sins, carrying off each other into bondage, whoring after false gods, and violation of commandments. In this light, the adoption of the term by Christians is hardly surprising. Redemption was a release from one's burden of sin and guilt, and the end of history would be that moment when all slates were wiped clean and all debts finally lifted, when a great blast from angelic trumpets will announce the final Jubilee. If so, redemption is no longer about buying something back. It's really more a matter of destroying the entire system of accounting. In many Middle Eastern cities, this was literally true. One of the common acts during debt cancellation was the ceremonial destruction of the tablets on which financial records had been kept, an act to be repeated, much less officially, in just about every major peasant revolt in history. This leads to another problem. What's possible in the meantime, before that final redemption comes? In one of his more disturbing parables, the parable of the unforgiving servant, Jesus seemed to be explicitly playing with the problem. Quote, Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. The servant fell on his knees before him. Be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything. The servant's master took pity on him, cancelled the debt, and let him go. But when that servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. He grabbed him and began to choke him. Pay back what you owe me, he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, "Be patient with me, and I will pay you back." But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed, and went and told their master everything that had happened. Then the master called the servant in. "You wicked servant," he said, "I cancelled all of that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant, just as I had on you?" In anger, his master turned him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all he owed. Unquote. This is quite an extraordinary text. On one level, it's a joke. In others, it could hardly be more serious. We begin with the king wishing to settle accounts with his servants. The premise is absurd. Kings, like gods, can't really enter into relations of exchange with their subjects, since no parity is possible. And this is a king who clearly is God. Certainly there can be no final settling of accounts. So, at best, we're dealing with an act of whimsy on the king's part. The absurdity of the premise is hammered home by the sum the first man brought before him is said to owe. In ancient Judea, to say someone owes a creditor 10,000 talents would be now like saying someone owes $100 billion. The number is a joke, too. It simply stands in for a sum no human being could ever conceivably repay. Faced with infinite existential debt, the servant can only tell obvious lies. $100 billion, sure, I'm good for it, just give me a little more time. Then, suddenly, apparently just as arbitrarily, the Lord forgives him. Yet, it turns out, the amnesty has a condition he's not aware of. It's incumbent on his being willing to act in an analogous way to other humans. In this particular case, another servant who owes him, to translate again into contemporary terms, maybe $1,000. Failing the test, the human is cast into hell for all eternity, or until he should pay back all he owed, which in this case comes down to the same thing. The parable has long been a challenge to theologians. It's normally interpreted as a comment on the endless bounty of God's grace, and how little he demands of us in comparison, and thus, by implication, as a way of suggesting that torturing us in hell for all eternity is not as unreasonable as it might seem. Certainly, the unforgiving servant is a genuinely odious character. Still, what is even more striking to me is the tacit suggestion that forgiveness, in this world, is ultimately impossible. Christians practically say as much every time they recite the Lord's Prayer and ask God to forgive us our debts as we also forgive our debtors. It repeats the story of the parable almost exactly, and the implications are simply dire. After all, most Christians reciting the prayer are aware that they do not generally forgive their debtors. Why then should God forgive them their sins? What's more, there is the lingering suggestion that we really couldn't live up to those standards even if we tried. One of the things that makes the Jesus of the New Testament such a tantalizing character is that it's never clear what he's telling us. Everything can be read two ways. When he calls on his followers to forgive all debts, refuse to cast the first stone, turn the other cheek, love their enemies, to hand over their possessions to the poor, is he really expecting them to do this? Or are such demands just a way of throwing in their faces that since we are not clearly prepared to act in this way, we are all sinners whose salvation can only come in another world? A position that can be, and has been, used to justify almost anything. This is a vision of human life as inherently corrupt, but it also frames even spiritual affairs in commercial terms, with calculations of sin, penance, and absolution. The devil and St. Peter, with their rival ledger books, usually accompanied by that creeping feeling that it's all a charade, because the very fact that we're reduced to playing such a game of tabulating sins reveals us to be fundamentally unworthy of forgiveness. World religions, as we shall see, are full of this kind of ambivalence. On the one hand, they are outcries against the market. On the other, they tend to frame their objections in commercial terms, as if to argue that turning human life into a series of transactions is not a very good deal. What I think even these few examples reveal, though, is how much is being papered over in the conventional accounts of the origins and history of money. There is something almost touchingly naive in the stories about neighbors swapping potatoes for an extra pair of shoes. When the ancients thought about money, friendly swaps were hardly the first thing that came to mind. True, some might have thought about their tab at the local alehouse, or, if they were a merchant or administrator, of storehouses, account books, exotic imported delights. For most, though, what was likely to come to mind was the selling of slaves and the ransoming of prisoners, corrupt tax farmers, and the depredations of conquering armies, mortgages and interest, theft and extortion, revenge and punishment, and above all, the tension between the need for money to create families, to acquire a bride, so as to have children, and the use of that same money to destroy families, to create debts that lead to the same wife and children being taken away. Some of our daughters are brought under bondage already, neither is it in our power to redeem them. One can only imagine what those words meant, emotionally, to a father in a patriarchal society in which a man's ability to protect the honour of his family was everything. Yet this is what money meant to the majority of people for most of human history. The terrifying prospect of one's sons and daughters being carried off to the homes of repulsive strangers to clean their pots and provide the occasional sexual services, to be subject to every conceivable form of violence and abuse, possibly for years, conceivably for ever, as their parents waited, helpless, avoiding eye contact with their neighbours, who knew exactly what was happening, to those they were supposed to have been able to protect. Clearly, this was the worst thing that could happen to anyone, which is why, in the parable, it could be treated as interchangeable with being turned over to the jailers to be tortured for life. And that's just from the perspective of the father. One can only imagine how it might have felt to be the daughter. Yet, over the course of human history, untold millions of daughters have known, and in fact many still know, exactly what it's like. One might object that this was just assumed to be the nature of things. Like the imposition of tribute on conquered populations, it might have been resented, but it wasn't considered a moral issue, a matter of right and wrong. Some things just happen. This has been the common attitude of peasants to such phenomena throughout human history. What's striking about the historical record is that in the case of debt crises, this was not how many reacted. Many actually did become indignant. So many, in fact, that most of our contemporary language of social justice, our way of speaking of human bondage and emancipation, continues to echo the ancient arguments about debt. It's particularly striking because so many other things do seem to have been accepted as simply in the nature of things. One doesn't see a similar outcry against caste systems, for example, or, for that matter, the institution of slavery. Surely slaves and untouchables often experienced at least equal horrors. No doubt many protested their condition. Why was it that the debtors' protests seemed to carry such greater moral weight? Why were debtors so much more effective in winning the ear of priests, prophets, officials, and social reformers? Why was it that officials like Nehemiah were willing to give such sympathetic consideration to their complaints, to inveigh and to summon great assemblies? Some have suggested practical reasons. Debt crises destroyed the free peasantry, and it was the free peasants who were drafted into ancient armies to fight in wars. No doubt this was a factor. Clearly it wasn't the only one. There's no reason to believe that Nehemiah, for instance, in his anger at the usurers, was primarily concerned with the ability to levy troops for the Persian king. It's something more fundamental. What makes debt different is that it's premised on an assumption of equality. To be a slave or lower caste is to be intrinsically inferior. We're dealing with relations of unadulterated hierarchy. In the case of debt, we're dealing with two individuals who begin as equal parties to a contract. Legally, at least as far as the contract is concerned, they are the same. We can add that in the ancient world, when people who actually were more or less social equals loaned money to one another, the terms appear to have been normally quite generous. Often no interest was charged,
or if it was very low. "And don't charge me interest," wrote one wealthy Canaanite to another, in a tablet dated around 1200 BC. "After all, we are both gentlemen." Between close kin, many loans were probably, then as now, just gifts that no one seriously expected to recover. Loans between rich and poor were something else again. The problem was that, unlike status distinctions like caste or slavery, the line between rich and poor was never precisely drawn. One can imagine the reaction of a farmer who went up to the house of a wealthy cousin on the assumption that human beings help each other, and ended up, a year or two later, watching his vineyard seized and his sons and daughters led away. Such behaviour could be justified in legal terms by insisting that the loan was not a form of mutual aid, but a commercial relationship. A contract is a contract. It also required a certain reliable access to superior force. But it could only have felt like a terrible betrayal. What's more, framing it as a breach of contract meant stating that this was, in fact, a moral issue. These two parties ought to be equals, but one had failed to honour the bargain. Psychologically, this can only have made the indignity of the debtor's condition all the more painful, since it made it possible to say that it was his own turpitude that sealed his daughter's fate. But that just made the motive all the more compelling to throw back the moral aspersions. Our flesh is the same flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. We're all the same people. We have a responsibility to take account of one another's needs and interests. How, then, could my brother do this to me? In the Old Testament case, debtors were able to marshal a particularly powerful moral argument. As the authors of Deuteronomy constantly reminded their readers, were not the Jews all slaves in Egypt? And had they not all been redeemed by God? Was it right, when they had all been given this promised land to share, for some to take that land away from others? Was it right for a population of liberated slaves to go about enslaving one another's children? But analogous arguments were being made in similar situations almost everywhere in the ancient world. In Athens, in Rome, and for that matter in China, where legend had it that coinage itself was first invented by an ancient emperor to redeem the children of families who had been forced to sell them after a series of devastating floods. Through most of history, when overt political conflict between classes did appear, it took the form of pleas for debt cancellation, the freeing of those in bondage, and usually a more just reallocation of the land. What we see in the Bible and other religious traditions are traces of the moral arguments by which such claims were justified, usually subject to all sorts of imaginative twists and turns, but inevitably, to some degree, incorporating the language of the marketplace itself.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive.
We have new RSS and Atom feeds available. I finished them this week. On bottom left-hand corner of the website, unwelcomeguest.net.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving.